From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jane Clayson in Boston.
And I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles. This is Here and Now. We've been talking for weeks now about how hospitals are stretched to capacity. Hospitalizations have reached a record high this week, more than 140,000 COVID-19 patients. Let's hear now from a small rural hospital in Oconto, Wisconsin. Dr. Charles Heike works at Bellin Health Oconto Hospital and joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Heike, Oconto is a small town, just under 5,000 residents. How is this current surge of cases with the Omicron variant impacting you and your hospital?
Well, we are certainly seeing a lot more patients arriving into the emergency department with symptoms and worries about possibly having the Omicron or any COVID infection. Our hospital is so small, we do not have an intensive care unit or really the abilities to provide care locally for anyone that is seriously ill. And if someone is seriously ill, then we have to organize a transport for them down into one of the centers in Green Bay itself.
What about patients who don't come in to be treated for COVID-19 but test positive for it? How do you manage their care?
If their symptoms are not serious, and that's sometimes pretty difficult to measure over the phone, but most people kind of have a fairly good measure of whether they're feeling short of breath or their fever is out of control, or in a group of high-risk patients that just because of their other chronic diseases makes them worry, then we want to see those people. But if they're not in that category, then we give them some good guidelines to follow and really try and keep them home as much as possible.
Right. Even if you're not treating them, this is still having an impact in your hospital. What sort of strain is the surge having on other parts of the hospital and other patients coming in for non-COVID-related problems?
Yes. So if someone comes in with some other medical problem and we would normally keep them here, if they are COVID positive, we're unable to keep them here. We just don't have the facilities to be able to provide care. So one of the things is that everybody that's COVID positive and requires any sort of hospitalization, whether it's related to their COVID positivity or not, they're going to need to go into one of the larger specialty hospitals in Green Bay. Then the problem now is that all of those specialty hospitals are filled to the gills with patients. And so with that limited capacity, it's been a real strain sometimes where patients are waiting several hours for our ability just to find a hospital that might be able to take them.
How has the coronavirus impacted your staff?
Everyone is tired. Everyone is concerned, and you can only maintain that concern for so long before it starts to have an impact on how you feel and how you do things. So one of the big areas of focus is to keep a good look on our team members and watch and see how they're doing and do our best to do the little things that help make the day a little bit brighter and get people through. But then there still are numbers. So we have our administrative nursing staff, for example, who are working many extra hours than they normally would, just fulfilling basic duty shifts in either the emergency department or our medical unit, just in order to keep things going. It's a fatiguing thing, both psychologically and physically, and we are in the midst of what appears to be this next surge. The predictions are perhaps another week or two, and we may see some numbers start to go down, but it's a challenge. It's a big challenge.
That's Dr. Charles Heike with Bellin Health Oconto Hospital in Oconto, Wisconsin. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Last year was the deadliest year for weather and climate disasters in a decade. That's the finding of a new report out this week from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. NOAA also counted 20 disasters that each exceeded $1 billion in damage. In other words, we're seeing weather and climate events getting much more costly. And as we know, these disasters all too well, hurricanes Ida and Nicholas, wildfires raging through the West, hailstorms in Texas. Joining us now to explain all of this is Adam Smith, a climatologist and economist with NOAA. Hi, Adam.
Hi.
Well, your report says weather and climate disasters caused $145 billion of damage last year. That's up from $102 billion in 2020. Run us through the kinds of disasters you were counting.
Yeah, so in 2021, the United States experienced 20 separate billion-dollar weather and climate disasters. And of these disasters, these included one winter storm cold wave event, one drought heat wave event, two flood events, three tornado outbreaks, four hurricane events, eight severe storm events, and finally, another destructive wildfire season.
Runs the gamut. You've got one of everything in there.
Yes. In fact, what made 2021 a bit different from most years is we experienced pretty much all of the extremes that we focus on in this particular analysis.
So as an economist, what factors were you tallying up as you were determining which events rose to $1 billion in losses or damages?
Yeah. So this analysis looks at the total direct costs, looking at the physical assets such as homes, businesses, vehicles, all the contents within those structures, even time element losses like business interruption. But of course, we look at agricultural losses too, for example, what crops are damaged from the drought. Also public infrastructure such as roads, bridges, levee systems. So this is a solid conservative estimate.
And did you look at who pays for the recovery of these disasters? Is it ultimately falling on taxpayers through FEMA or private insurance companies?
Yes, who pays for these disasters is really a combination of homeowners insurance, business insurance, damage to vehicles, but also the government, whether it's state government, federal government, through programs like FEMA manages. And really, the extreme event dictates what ratio is public versus private funded recovery costs for these different disasters.
So 2021 was extremely costly and was also one of the hottest years on record. Tell us how climate change impacts these costly weather events.
Yeah, so the damage cost from these 20 separate billion-dollar disaster events was $145 billion last year, which is the third highest on record, only behind 2017 and 2005. Also, this year follows a series of years where we've had a high frequency, a high cost, and a large diversity of extremes. And unfortunately, over the last 5 years, the total cost from these disasters is $742 billion, which is a new record. And there are several reasons for why we're seeing this. One, we have more exposure, population, material assets in harm's way, in vulnerable places like river floodplains, the wildland-urban interface, or of course the coast where a lot of people like to live. We're also becoming a little bit more vulnerable to these extremes, where we build and how we build. But of course, climate change is a driver for a lot of these extremes that become billion-dollar disasters.
So talk more about those different extremes. Are you seeing different kinds of disasters becoming costlier over time or more frequent?
Yes. In fact, we're seeing both more frequent and more costly disasters for different types. For example, in the 2010s decade, the United States had more non-hurricane, just heavy rainfall flooding events during the 2010s decade than it did in the previous three decades combined. And this is all inflation adjusted to present day dollars. Also in the West, four out of the last five wildfire seasons have reached or eclipsed $10 billion in total losses. And we didn't see the $10 billion number until 2017. And so that's another trend that's kind of going in the wrong direction in regards to extremes and costs.
It seems to be a very bleak picture, Adam. Talk to us about what can be done to help prepare for all this. What should communities be doing ahead of the next wildfire season or the next hurricane season?
Perhaps one of the silver linings from 2021 is that the levee and pumping system that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers built around New Orleans was tested by Hurricane Ida, and it seemed to have mitigated some of the damage that would have otherwise taken place if that system wasn't built. So that's one good example of a region and a hazard. But we have many, many such examples like that that have to be looked at and analyzed and perhaps to build better infrastructure to mitigate some of these extremes, which we know are going to continue to happen as we move into the future.
So we need to consider where we build, how we build, and really build more resilient infrastructure.
That's correct. All of the above. And I think every year that passes, it's becoming more and more clear. And if one was to do a cost-benefit analysis, I mean, it really pays for itself in the long term. It's a wise investment at many levels, at the individual level or even at the state or national level for different hazards and different extremes that we have to face.
I'm curious how you talk about the future of our climate with the younger generation, those who will be around for the next 70, 80, or 90 years. What do you say to them?
I think that what's interesting is it does seem that the young generation, I have two children myself, they're very aware, more so than we perhaps realize, of what's happening in the world and what's changing and perhaps even the decisions that are made and maybe are not made. And, you know, in the future, of course, they will be us. They will be the leaders making the decisions. So as long as they can look at the future with a glass half full mentality, I'm optimistic that they will continue the progress we're also trying to make right now.
That's Adam Smith, a climatologist and economist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Film scholar Will Haygood wrote after the death of actor Sidney Poitier last week that for decades, black actors and directors such as Lee Daniels and David Oyelowo wanted to meet Poitier to ask him questions. And not only because Poitier was the first black man to win an Oscar for Best Actor, Oyelowo said Poitier was the gold standard of what was possible. Joining us now is Ruben Santiago Hudson, who recently starred in, wrote, and directed the play Lackawanna Blues. He is currently directing Skeleton Crew on Broadway with Felicia Rashad, which opens January 26th. He is artistic advisor for the Manhattan Theater Club, and he's been slated to direct a play about Poitier's life on Broadway. Ruben, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here.
I love those words. Sidney Poitier was the gold standard of what was possible. How does that resonate for you in your career and in your life?
It's a big statement because it means more than one thing. What's possible as an artist? What's possible as a black artist? What's possible as a father and a man? You know, Sidney Poitier did not set a standard. He was the standard.
What questions did you ask Mr. Poitier when you met him, and what did you learn from him?
I was so in awe that I didn't ask many questions. I sat there and let him, you know, talk and let me just soak it up, you know. And the things that he asked me were more about, like, my mother. So we talked more of that kind of thing. We didn't talk about art. We didn't talk about, you know, those lofty goals that a young artist, young compared to Sidney, I am, would have, or an artist in his career would have. We talked about humanity things, human things.
We've heard him described in many ways, his eloquence, his grace. How would you describe him? What words would you use?
Royalty is the first thing that comes to me. Integrity, class, humility. I don't say I was I knew Mr. Poitier well. I knew him in this part of his life, in this latter part of his life, but when I was introduced and I sat there in his home, and he looked at me in awe, like I thought like a bird had droppings on my head or something. He looked at me and he said, "What happened to your hair?" And his wife, Joanne, said to him, "What happened to yours, Sidney?" And that broke the ice and we just laughed. And just, you know, just spending time in his presence. It's like, you know, I guess people in Britain would think that you were with the king, or well, there's no king in Britain, but the queen. You know, it was that kind of loyalty, just awe.
One of Sidney Poitier's most famous scenes was in the 1967 film In the Heat of the Night, where Poitier plays a detective from Philadelphia who deals with a racist Mississippi police chief. Here's a clip.
Well, you're pretty sure of yourself, ain't you, Virgil? Virgil, that's a funny name for a boy that comes from Philadelphia. What do they call you up there?
They call me Mr. Tibbs.
Mr. Tibbs! Well, Mr. Wood, take Mr. Tibbs! Take him.
New York Times critic at large Wesley Morris calls Poitier the greatest American movie star, not the greatest black movie star. Do you agree?
Yes, I do agree. I do agree because, first of all, the boundaries that he had to leap over, the walls that he had to break down, the things that were, everything was against him. And he overcame them all with grace and humility and power.
Wesley Morris writes that Poitier was, quote, as crucial in the odyssey of freedom and equity for black Americans, for personhood, as Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, as Martin Luther King Jr. He was a transformative figure, Ruben.
Yes, Mr. Poitier allowed us the opportunity to peek through that door and maybe push it in a little bit and get inside that door that is Hollywood, because he proved a lot of things right that people thought were wrong about Black actors, about our standard, about refusing to accept mediocrity, about refusing to play low, below who we are as human beings and people.
There's another scene I want to play for you from In the Heat of the Night that cultural critic Bijan Vane called one of the most memorable scenes in movie history. Poitier is slapped by a racist white textile tycoon who is getting away with murder, and Poitier slaps him right back.
Was Mr. Colbert ever in this greenhouse, say, last night about midnight?
That moment, writes the critic Bain, sent stunned hushes and hurrahs through theaters across the country.
They call it the slap heard around the world. You know, and it was very interesting that Mr. Poitier had in his contract that that film could not be shown anywhere in the world if you cut that slap out, that it had to be included. It was in his contract. And he refused to do the film, it wouldn't be in his contract. So they put that in his contract. So whenever you see that movie, you know, where they have cut out a lot of things, interracial relationships, people kissing from different races, they cut that out of a lot of movies, particularly in those days. He demanded that he be treated with integrity and that the things that matter to him most would be a part of his legacy. And that's his integrity and who he was as a man and as a human being.
Sidney Poitier won his Best Actor Oscar for his role as a down-on-his-luck traveling handyman who stops by a convent of German nuns in remote Arizona. I want to play a clip here.
You go to bed. Tomorrow Sunday is. The mass in town is 9 by the clock.
I'm a Baptist. I don't go to mass.
We go.
Well, how'd you get there before I came along?
We walk every Sunday. Now we got you.
Now, damn it! You ain't got me.
Good night, Schmidt.
Now get that very straight.
Schlafen Sie wohl,
and cut that out.
Bless you, Schmidt.
Mr. Santiago Hudson, you spoke about Sidney Poitier breaking boundaries and setting the standard. How do you think Hollywood changed because of him?
Well, first of all, Hollywood realized that there was a financial gain. And when Sidney Poitier, Sir Sidney Poitier, proved that you didn't have to be white to be a star and bring money into the studios, it changed the game. But how much? Not much. Years and decades passed until Denzel Washington was the next star, African-American star, to receive an Oscar. Black films had made money. That's clear. But what marketable Black star could open up a movie? Like some of the films that people don't talk about, A Warm December, first film that I think this Black doctor that Sidney played dealt with a woman with sickle cell anemia, which is a disease that is exclusively to Black people. So we dealt with an issue about our community that's never dealt with a Black doctor here.
Let's listen to a clip of that film.
I think you're very devious.
Girl, blowing people's minds must be your hobby.
Girl, don't you ever hold still for 1 second?
Stay in London and find out.
And people don't talk about A Warm December or some of the first love stories with a Black woman, the love of Ivy.
We found a clip. Here it is.
I'm taking you into the city. That's where you wanted to go in the first place, isn't it? Well, now you get what you want.
How does anybody know what I want? Nobody asks me. People just tell me. Ivy stay. Ivy go. Doesn't anybody say please?
Another film that I think should have many more accolades, Buck and the Preacher. He did a Western with Harry Belafonte that made heroes and villains of Black people instead of just villains or stereotypes or parts and pieces of who we are as people. They were both whole human beings with good and bad.
We're going to just ride and sometime walk in their back and just take it.
That's right.
You're crazy.
Those films were quite lucrative. They really lit the African-American community up. We loved those films. I showed them to my kids. We watched them together and we still repeat lines.
One of his most popular movies was in 1967, To Sir With Love, who, as a teacher, gains the respect of unruly high school students in London. Here's a clip.
First of all, the bleeding alarm didn't go. Then I had to wait hours for a bus. Do you know, I think I must have stood there for about 3 bleeding hours waiting for
a bus.
Example.
There are 2 ways to enter a room. One is like an adult, a lady with dignity. The other is like a brat. Miss Dare has just shown us the second way. Perhaps you would care to demonstrate the first.
Just to hear him speak, it's so moving. He had such a way, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And also, when you really watch his films, watch his eyes, watch how the intention in his eyes, the story behind the story that's in his eyes. He looks at other actors and he bores through them into their heart, to their soul. And he demands something from other actors that lifts and raises their game, that makes them have to come to the game hotter, harder, stronger, more truthful. That's the kind, as an actor, that's what you dream of, that you can look across at a person that demands more from you. And Mr. Poitier did that in every film.
Ruben Santiago Hudson is a playwright, director of the Broadway show Skeleton Crew, and artistic advisor of the Manhattan Theater Club. Mr. Santiago Hudson, thank you very much. What a delight to have you.
It's been a pleasure, and I appreciate any opportunity I can to applaud Sir Sidney Poitier.
Millions of employees across the country can't access the critical software they use to get paid. The outage has lasted for weeks and could last longer. It all has to do with a ransomware attack last month against payroll giant Kronos. NPR's Becky Sullivan has been reporting on this story and joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, Tanya.
Becky, this story is personal for you. NPR is actually among the companies that uses Kronos. Mm-hmm. What effect is this having on the people impacted by this hack?
Yeah. So, you know, NPR is one of about 2,000 employers who use some of the software made by Kronos. And it includes some really large employers, too, like New York's Metropolitan Transportation Authority, FedEx, Whole Foods, Pepsi, the city of Cleveland, quite a few major hospitals and healthcare systems. It really couldn't come at a worse time. So nurses in some places, including in Jacksonville, Florida, and in Missoula, Montana, have reported inaccurate paychecks that don't accurately reflect the amount of overtime and holiday pay they've had to work over these last few weeks. And I think a lot of people are wondering if any of their personal identifying information has been compromised. And that really depends on what your employer put into Kronos. But it's a good bet that at the minimum, your name, maybe some contact information, and some basic employment information may have been compromised.
Let's back up a little bit. How did this happen and how long might this keep going for?
Yeah. So UKG has been pretty tight-lipped about the details of the attack, but we do know that it was a ransomware attack, meaning that some of their systems were knocked offline by hackers who are looking for ransom, basically, to restore the data. That was discovered about a month ago. In terms of how long it might keep going, UKG says it's working as fast as possible to bring employers back online. A couple of weeks ago, they said that all employers should be back by the end of this month, but they're only just starting to bring people back now, and it's very complex because often the software is very tailored to the needs of individual employers. I talked to Brad Purdy. He's the chief information security officer for the city of Santa Fe, New Mexico. He says they're mostly operating okay. It's been a hassle, but people are getting paid accurately. He says the city is ready to make the switch back as soon as Kronos tells them that they're good to go.
They said it could be weeks and weeks and weeks. But basically, I think at this point, it's mostly just a confidence level on their side, because it's sounding like they've got all the ducks in a row and they're ready to go. But if I was in their shoes, I'd be overly cautious too.
And one last thing to mention, the longer this drags on, the higher the odds are that it could delay some tax documents from employers because of the timing of the hack right at the end of the year. If Kronos isn't back up to help them keep track of all those hours and all that pay, you might have to employers might have to manually calculate all of that year-end information in time to issue W-2s.
A major headache. How damaging is this for Kronos? Is there anything they can do to win the trust of their clients back?
you know, it's really not great. I spoke to John Ritchie of the American Hospital Association, who told me while they acknowledge that it is the ransomware attackers who are ultimately responsible for this, there still is a lot of disappointment with the way Kronos has handled things. There's a high likelihood that Kronos will face legal action from customers. A spokesperson for the MTA in New York told me that the agency has taken the first steps toward initiating legal action. There's already one class action lawsuit that's been filed in federal court over the breach of people's private information. But they do have one thing going for them, which is that workforce management software is pretty sticky, in the words of Scott Cannery, who's a cybersecurity firm CEO. He told me that the nature of their product means that customers are just less likely to switch than if they were in a different industry.
That's NPR's Becky Sullivan. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been hearing about the unconventional places people are offering vaccines: barbershops, hair salons, and if you're in Toronto, a strip club. Last July, Maggie's Toronto Sex Workers Action Project, run for and by sex workers, began organizing vaccine clinics in strip clubs and other locations around the city. Through partnerships with local health organizations, they've helped vaccinate more than 3,000 people to date. And here to tell us more about this is Ellie Attiker, a clinic organizer and board member at Maggie's. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. Tell us a little bit more about the backstory here. How did Maggie's start organizing vaccine clinics?
Right. So Maggie's is actually one of Canada's oldest sex worker justice organizations. And so we've been doing public health work in the form of street outreach, distributing safe sex and drug use supplies for nearly 35 years in Toronto's downtown East End. And so when the pandemic hit us in Toronto in earlier 2020, one of the things that we saw really quickly was that sex workers were very quickly left behind. They couldn't access emergency benefits. A lot of our workplaces were being closed down. And on top of that, Ontario started introducing a lot of measures further criminalizing communities such as ours. It became very apparent to us quite quickly that vaccine access was a huge issue, not just in our community, but across a lot of poor, working class, undocumented communities, particularly where we're located in the downtown East, which for listeners who maybe aren't familiar with Toronto is really sort of the epicenter of our city's war on drugs. And so we tried to step up very quickly by organizing vaccine clinics and sort of responding to a lot of public backlash from our local mayor in the city, John Tory, as well as Ontario's Premier, Doug Ford, who specifically sort of called out sex workers and strip clubs,
right,
and sort of named these communities as responsible for the spread of COVID.
Yes, we actually have tape from the Premier, Doug Ford, from August of 2020. Let's listen.
I feel sorry
Thank
for the
you.
People
and,
when they go to their house and tell them that they were at the Brass Rail. That's who I feel sorry for. Sorry for the spouse. Seriously. Man, I wouldn't want to be on the end of that one.
And what Ford was talking about there was the spread of COVID before there was a vaccine inside of strip clubs. Do you see parallels to the HIV/AIDS epidemic and the way sex workers were shunned as spreaders of the disease?
Yeah, I mean, at Maggie's and through a lot of our public health work, we've absolutely been dealing with this narrative from not only local politicians, but also police and the press and public that sort of paint sex workers as threats to public health. And for context, what Premier Ford was responding to was a question about a confirmed case of COVID in a local strip club in Toronto called the Brass Rail. I think it's also important that people understand that, you know, when it's acceptable for our political leaders to make these kinds of degrading remarks about an entire class of worker, especially in the context of sex work, this is the kind of language that justifies the kind of criminalization and violent policing that we've been seeing escalating throughout the pandemic as well. And so it's so much more than just like a degrading remark or an innocuous sort of joke. It has real life consequences for sex workers in our communities that we have to deal with.
And how have members in the community responded to these clinics?
I think one of the things that's very important about these clinics is that they're low barrier in nature. And so one of the things that means is that we don't require ID from people to be able to access the vaccine. And we've been running these clinics through a time where vaccine access in our community has been a massive issue. When Ontario started rolling out vaccine access, it was often predicated on your postal code. And so you had to provide proof of address, often photo ID, health proof of health coverage, and things like that. And that was something that a lot of sex workers traditionally shamed through medical systems and further sort of surveilled and criminalized weren't comfortable doing, but also something our community members living outdoors, for example, our undocumented community members, just weren't able to do to access a life-saving vaccine.
You started these clinics back in July. Are people still showing up for first shots or just boosters?
They absolutely are. I mean, the last clinic that we ran actually last week out of a local club in downtown Toronto called Zanzibar, one of the things that I think shocked us at Maggie's, as well as a lot of the doctors and nurses at University Health Network, is that we actually administered more first doses at that clinic in January of 2022, after running these for almost a year, more first doses that day than any other shot, than booster shots, than second doses, or anything like that.
For those who are still coming to the clinics, what do they tell you about what they're going through right now?
People are really struggling. And I think that as we move into another wave of the pandemic right now, now we're seeing more hospitalizations, we're seeing more death due to COVID. Just over this past weekend, actually, the chair of our paramedics union in Toronto called a code red. And so what that meant was that there were no more ambulances left in the city. We're North America's fourth largest city. No more ambulances left to deal with emergency calls. And so what we're seeing is our healthcare system locally really on the brink of collapse. I think our clinics offered people a safe and accessible way to be able to access the vaccine.
Maggie's also offers other services for sex workers, including a legal program and food boxes. As you look towards the next phase of this pandemic, what do you hope to achieve for the community going forward?
I think that our plans are really to keep doing work that helps our communities survive. And, you know, for listeners that maybe aren't familiar with the local context in Toronto right now, like we're dealing with a housing and shelter crisis. Right now, there are COVID outbreaks in 48 of our shelters right now. And that means that our local shelter system is no longer accepting people coming into it, despite the fact that most folks are still losing jobs and incomes and evictions are still being processed. And so we're really seeing this crisis around housing and local shelter heading into a very cold winter. I mean, locally in Toronto, on our streets, like people freeze to death out in the cold. And so I think on our end at Maggie's, our first priority is really going to be thinking about how we're showing up for sex workers through those conditions and running an emergency winter supply program.
That was Ellie Attiker, a clinic organizer and board member at Maggie's. Thank you so much for joining us in this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. It means so much.
We wanted to take a moment to remember Ronnie Spector, who died yesterday at the age of 78. Be My Baby was the breakout hit for her and pioneering girl group The Ronettes in 1963. She talked about her now famous vocal line in an interview with Fresh Air's Terry Gross back in 1987.
One of the things you do on this record is your famous, I can't even imitate this, but you're your famous what-uh-oh.
Yes.
Which you do a lot in Be My Baby and in a lot of your early records. Mm-hmm. How did you come up with that? Was that something you just started singing?
No, it was like Frankie Lyman used to sing, "Why do birds sing so gay? And love is a way with break of day. Why do they fall in love?" And so I sort of got it from him, and it was like my own little ho-ho's came out.
The Ronettes recorded other hits, including Baby, I Love You, The Best Part of Breaking Up, and Walking in the Rain, which she sang along with in that 1987 Fresh Air interview.
And I'll be certain he's my guy by the things he'll like to do. Like walking in the rain and wishing on the stars up above and being so in love. Oh, oh.
Ronnie. That sounds great. That's Ronnie Spector singing along with a record from the 1960s of Walking in the Rain.
I couldn't help it.
Oh, that's terrific.
Spector says she learned about music and style growing up in Spanish Harlem in New York, and along with her sister and cousin, called music producer Phil Spector out of the blue to get an audition. She ended up in an unhappy marriage to Spector for a while. She says Spector forbade her from singing during that time. Ronnie Spector went on to have a solo career in the 1970s and 80s and reprised her Be My Baby vocal line in the 1986 Eddie Money. Ronnie Spector died Wednesday after a brief battle with cancer. Did you make a resolution to eat healthier this year, but you're not terribly excited about your options? Well, Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst is here to help. She's been thinking up some new recipes to brighten your winter menu. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there, Jane.
Well, I just want to underscore, I did not use the word diet once in that introduction, right?
You didn't, and that's a good thing, because as soon as you call it a diet, then you're set up for failure, and there are a lot of rules, and people get wigged out, and many people do very well on diets. I like to use the word refocus to kind of refocus what I'm eating, what I'm shopping for, what I'm looking at on my table this winter month.
So refocus, eating lighter, less meat, more textures, lots of color. Is that what you're talking about?
Very much so. And those are all really key components. And all three of these recipes focus on color and texture and slightly more vegetables, more vegetable focus. The first one is a taco made with mushrooms. Mushrooms are really terrific when you want to reduce the amount of animal protein you're eating. They have a positively meaty texture and this rich umami flavor that is just such a satisfying alternative when you think you want meat, but you actually can be perfectly satisfied. So I took corn tortillas and heated them up with just a touch of sharp cheddar so that it melts on top of the tortilla. Meanwhile, I saute different mushrooms, really whatever you have on hand. I used shiitakes and king oysters, sauteed them in olive oil, not butter, with a little bit of scallion. Then you pile the mushrooms on this cheesy tortilla with a dollop of Greek yogurt, some salsa or chopped tomato, and fresh squeezed lime. Totally satisfying. Ooh. Honestly, it's a 15-minute recipe.
Sounds delicious. All right, tell us about the next one. It's a stir-fry recipe. How do you make that healthier?
Well, it's not fried. It's not deep fried. It's stir fried in the Asian tradition. You can make it in a wok or a heavy skillet. You use a little bit of vegetable oil, a lot of fresh ginger, and then I add a bunch of vegetables, leeks or onions, scallions, any raw vegetables you have in your fridge. I mean, broccoli or cauliflower florets, cubes of winter squash, anything you have around, stir fry that with some crunchy celery, a bit of miso paste, soy sauce, and then you add leftover cooked rice, and I throw in a bunch of greens, kale or spinach or Swiss chard. Everything is just stir fried in the wok, very little oil, and then a bunch of salted cashews or walnuts for, again, more texture, and then a fried egg that's fried in a bit of olive oil with a little chili pepper on top. So you have this rice dish with fresh ginger and crunchy vegetables and cashews with this creamy fried egg on top. Okay. Breakfast, lunch, or dinner.
My mouth is watering.
Are you hungry yet?
I am. That sounded really good. And you think stir fry, well, fry may not be good for you, but you've just made
now
it very, very healthy.
Yeah, maybe a tablespoon and a half of your favorite vegetable oil.
All right. Talk about roasting vegetables, because you're a big fan of that, and you've come up with a new dish that makes them sort of the star of the meal. Tell us about it.
I am. Roasting, particularly this time of year, warms the kitchen. But what it does, for instance, to a whole cauliflower, you take a whole cauliflower, you put it in a hot oven with some olive oil, some spices. You also roast chickpeas. You can take them from the can, you rinse them, drain them, and they go on a cookie sheet with some cinnamon and cumin, and you roast them until they become crunchy. This is a great snack, by the way. And then the roasted cauliflower, the roasted chickpeas, and some roasted cherry tomatoes, if you can find them, are all tossed together with Israeli or pearl couscous. And then at the last minute, you dress it with the juice of a large lemon, some olive oil, and fresh chopped parsley. And this is the epitome of color, texture, and again, I could eat this breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It really could be a main course dinner. Just wonderful roasted vegetables with Israeli couscous and fresh, sharp lemon.
It sounds delicious. Do you put the veggies all on at once, or do you layer them based on their size and density?
No, simple. You toss them with the couscous, but at the very end, you keep aside a few of the chickpeas to sprinkle on top, almost like croutons, but way healthier because it has this fabulous crunch that you want to experience on top of the salad. Mm.
I know Tanya's going to join us here, and we're both wondering, you know, all these resolutions that we make to eat healthier. How are you making your stick, Kathy?
Well, a resolution is a tough word. Again, it does set you up for some failure. We're in the middle of a raging pandemic. It's very cold in much of the country. I say focus on looking for beautiful winter vegetables and finding interesting, colorful ways to cook them, like these recipes.
Tanya, I'm going for the stir fry. What about you?
I know, me too. Stir fry all the way.
Well, Kathy Gunst, you're always great and always give us great ideas. We'll have all your recipes at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. Hungry, Tanya, hungry.
I know, it's lunchtime. And I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles. This is Here and Now.